The Jericho Network on Westwood One.
Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
Daddy, where do babies come from?
Honey?
Mommy went to the store.
Oh, well, you see, there's a mommy and a daddy, right?
Right.
And see, when they call Geico, they could save a bunch of money on car insurance.
Oh, really? And that makes them happy?
Yes, that makes them very happy.
That's good.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we could have this talk, Sunshine.
Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
Okay, people, tomorrow morning, 10 a.m., Santa's coming to town.
Santa! Oh, my God!
Santa here? I know him. I know him.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He's a world champion wrestler, best-selling author, actor, and lead singer of Fozzie. Now he's rocking the podcast world.
Fragile. It must be Italian.
This is Talk Is Jericho. Talk Is Jericho, starring Chris Jericho.
Oh, yeah. Welcome to Talk Is Jericho. It's the pod of fun and rock and roll right before Christmas time. Let's get the weekend started with the one and only purveyor of rotten jokes. It's Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, the bass player for Guns N' Roses, Duff McKagan.
Hey, Chris Jericho. This is Duff McKagan calling you. I was going to ask you, what do you call a Frenchman wearing these sandals? A Frenchman wearing these sandals. Philippe Philop. Thank you very much.
Philippe Philop. Took me a couple seconds to get that one right. I can barely get a laugh going for that one, though. Actually, no, I thought that was pretty funny. But thank you, Duff, for always phoning them in. Literally, Duff is now finished with the Guns N' Roses tour until this summer. In the meantime, and in between time, I just saw today that he's putting out another Walking Papers album, one of his solo projects. So no new Guns N' Roses record, but there is a new Duff McKagan record. So that's always good news. And there's a new episode of Talk Is Jericho, which is also always good news. And today we get back into kind of the spooky, mysterious conspiracy theory type of a show. It's history's mysteries. We're talking all about the unexplained strange occurrences throughout the course of history. And I'm doing it with my good buddies from Gemini Syndrome, the band that we toured with a few months ago. Fozzie Gemini Syndrome went out in the United States for a few weeks on the Judas Rising tour. I got singer Aaron Nordstrom and drummer Brian Steele Medina from Gemini Syndrome. They're here. We're not talking music. Like I said, we're talking history's mysteries, theories about the history of the world and religion, stuff like the Freemasons, which Brian is actually a member of, the Illuminati, the ancient Chinese mafia, Stonehenge, and the pyramids of ancient Egypt and Mexico. We're talking about the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus Christ, evolution versus science, and the eight levels of consciousness that Timothy Leary was in constant search of. It's some pretty deep stuff, and it's all very creepy and very thought-provoking. Fascinating conversation with Aaron and Brian of Gemini Syndrome. Like I said, we recorded this in September when Fozzie and Gemini were touring together. This show is going to make you think and ask questions right down to whether or not Christopher Columbus truly discovered America and what really happened after he got here. History's Mysteries coming up next. I'm saying that pretty quickly. History's Mysteries coming up next. And while you begin to ponder that, let me remind you that Alpha versus Omega is 2 weeks away, January 4th at the Tokyo Dome in Japan. And if you want to be a part of the Alpha Club, you want to join in on the Alpha Club Jericho, then just go to hottopic.com or go to any Hot Topic location and get the Alpha Club t-shirt. It's blue. It's got little lists on it, if you notice that, with an Omega symbol. So Kenny's on the list. I wore this when I attacked Kenny in Fukuoka, and it's all the rage. Hot Topic called me pretty much right after that show, which was December 11th or whatever it was, and we rushed job, got it into stores. It is the number one selling t-shirt in Hot Topic right now, and you're talking about they've got Bullet Club t-shirts, they've got Stranger Things and Riverdale and Harry Potter and Star Wars And here, your little host with the most, Chris Jericho's Alpha Club shirt is the number one selling shirt in Hot Topic. So go to any Hot Topic locations and find it, or go to hottopic.com and look up Alpha Club, Chris Jericho. All of those will take you straight to the Alpha Club shirt. It's a good looking shirt. Go check it out now. And check out Fozzy as we continue the Judas Rising tour, February 28th in New Orleans. We're going all across the United States, 30 dates, Dallas, Houston, Lubbock, Chicago, Detroit, Grand Rapids, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Diego, Las Vegas, El Paso, you name it, we're going there. I believe Albuquerque, Tucson, Phoenix. We're going to check that out. We're going to be rocking all the way across the United States with Through Fire, Santa Cruz, and Dark Sky Choir. Go to FozzyRock.com for all the gig information, cities, dates, venues, ticket information. And you know we're doing the VIP meet and greet, so get in and get in on that before they sell out, because nobody does VIP like Fozzy. We give you a whole pre-show mini concert. We're playing songs you're not going to hear later on that night, songs that you've never heard Fozzy play before. We're going to meet you. We're going to greet you. We're going to sign your stuff, take pictures, everything you want. One of the best experiences in rock and roll, the Fozzy VIP experience. At FozzyRock.com. We're doing it for all the European Fozzy fans as well, as we're on tour with Steel Panther starting January 28th in Paris, Paris, France. And we're going to Luxembourg. We're going to the Netherlands. We're going to Norway, Germany, Spain, all across Europe with Steel Panther. You can find out all that information once again at FozzyRock.com. So we're going to get back to discussing history's mysteries with Aaron and Brian from Gemini Syndrome. But first, I want to thank WWE Hall of Famer Diamond Dallas Page and his unbelievable DDP yoga. That's why I'm able to take on Kenny Omega at the Tokyo Dome in the most buzzed about, most talked about wrestling match of the year. At 47 years old, I'm going to whip Kenny's ass. So I'm able to keep on rocking as hard as I do with Fozzy. All thanks to DDP yoga. And if you've already booked your cabin for Chris Jericho's Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea for October 27th, 2018, then you'll have a chance to experience DDP Yoga with Dallas himself. He'll be hosting live DDP Yoga workshops on the boat. And DDP Yoga is the perfect workout for any age and skill level. And now Dallas has even come up with a modified version for those with limited mobility and those a little even older. The new program is called DDPUI Rebuild. It's designed to take you from the bed to the chair to eventually standing by your own, by yourself, on your own, by yourself. Dallas is 61, looks 51, acts 41. He wants to give all of you, especially the elder listeners of Talk is Jericho, a chance to live and thrive. DDPUI Rebuild is the perfect holiday gift for your parents, grandparents, even your great-grandparents, if they're still around, God bless them. Get them the gift that's going to help them rebuild their lives, keep them mobile and active and living life to the fullest. Go to ddpyoga.com/rebuild to learn more and to pre-order the DDPY Rebuild Program. Take advantage of Dallas's biggest sale ever, 30% off all DVDs, app memberships, and all DDP Yoga apparel. Go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho. No better time to get on board the DDPY train. Choo-choo. Change your life. Own your life. Get in the best mental and physical condition you've ever been in. Start today. Go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho. That's ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Go check it out now.
Hey, this is Chris Jericho inviting you to the first ever Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea. Picture this: rock and roll, wrestling, comedy, live podcasting, all on the open ocean from October 27th to the 31st, 2018, from Miami to Nassau. I'm bringing Hall of Fame wrestlers, some of the greatest rock and roll bands on the planet, and putting the first wrestling ring on a cruise ship ever. Don't be a stupid idiot. Make the list. Check us out at ChrisJerichoCruise.com.
Talk is Jericho.
Okay, so we're on tour with Gemini Syndrome, and Aaron and I were talking about doing a podcast, and then the other night in the gas station, I run into Brian, who's also a Gemini, and you started asking about some of the conspiracy theories that I have. I don't know if you listen. Do you listen to
the
Talk
is Jericho? I listen to the one, yeah.
Okay, so you know that I have a lot of paranormal conspiracies. Then you open up this whole new world of these type of conspiracies and this type of like revisionist history, which I found out Aaron is also into. So the whole Gemini Syndrome podcast morphed into what we're going to talk about today, which I'm not completely familiar with. So maybe you guys can kind of lay the groundwork of what we're going to be discussing.
the question you got to ask is, did we conspire to turn it into a conspiracy podcast?
Is it a conspiracy of a conspiracy?
Conspiracy within a conspiracy.
It's worked on both ends, right?
The inception.
We're in. So tell me exactly what you were talking about.
Well, yeah, the conversation that me and you got into the other night was basically about how, you know, the larger conspiracies, we still live within them and we don't know, you know, much like in, you know, 500 years ago where they didn't, it wasn't necessarily a widespread understanding that the Earth was round or flat, or, you know, they almost kind of didn't even think about it back then. It wasn't like there were hardline people going like, the Earth is round, the Earth is flat. It was just something that they didn't really think to question back then. And so now we live in an age where there's lots of things that we don't think to question, one of them being what we're taught, our understanding of history. We have a, we're constantly gaining, you know, knowledge with you know, the universe and space and our place within the universe and within our galaxy. And then that feels so big that we don't ever really think back to like, well, what about what we know about ourselves? I'm thinking now more than ever, over the last 10 years, you know, Americans are getting really comfortable with the idea of the reality behind what Christopher Columbus was and what happened with that, and have a real understanding, you know, and, you know, even like, with the assassination of JFK and those kind of things. And we kind of are having an understanding where, in hindsight, we look back and go, oh, well, that's pretty obvious that that was messed up. Or
so you're talking about revisionist history to where people are just accepting what they've been told and not really questioning? Is that kind of what we're discussing here?
Yeah, a little bit. Well, yeah, that. But then, but the thing is like, there was never an official announcement that like, hey everyone, JFK was assassinated, you know, for a much bigger reason than what we were taught, you know. And there was never really one day somewhere on the news they're like, oh, by the way, Columbus was, you know, a genocidal maniac, you know, like that never.
Let's talk about this. You mentioned Columbus a few times. You're talking about the Flat Earth Society, where there's a lot of people who believe that the Earth is flat, one big long plane, in comparison to the world being round.
Which now, I love.
Yeah, they
you love that idea.
I'm just
they call it the globular Earth model.
Yeah. So which side of the coin are you guys on?
Oh, I'm on the side of the globular Earth model.
The picture in space of the globe.
Yeah. That's, well, the reason those people I think the reason why those things kind of pop up is because there are larger things that we are lied to about. So then they start kind of overdoing it and finding holes in stories where maybe they don't necessarily have the expertise to kind of dig into it. You know what I mean?
What were you saying about Columbus being a maniac? What was that all about?
Well, yeah, well, because, I mean, just even the now that we have access to the actual historical, you know, documents of what happened, you know, I mean, he was only like coming out here as a last ditch effort. You know, he went to many different countries trying to get funding to like do explorations, and he was turned down again and again and again and again. And when he finally came here, you know, he came with a kind of bunch of, you know, renegades, kind of got here, went back, and then, you know, brought a couple slaves with him, and then came back again and, you know, kind of wiped everything out there. But
gotcha.
He was looking for stuff that they didn't even have, you know.
So you're saying that's the concept of how people because of this, all these other things that people are finding out, that you can believe in a flat Earth society,
yeah,
or that the moon landing never happened, or some,
yeah,
of those type of things. So what's going to be some of the events that we're discussing in actuality of what you're pointing at?
Well, one of the things that we were talking about is how we take it for granted that, you know, that the pyramids were built, you know, like 3,000 years ago, and that, you know, our clock kind of starts around the time of Jesus. Our whole clock is based off of, you know,
Jesus' birth.
Yeah, we're like, we were either AD or BC, and anything that's before BC, we kind of chalk it up to like, oh, well, that was archaic times, and we kind of have this big, unless you're like super into history, you know, then there's a big gap that kind of happens between 0 and 1500, and we are just kind of don't even like really think about it, don't even really question it, you know. And so about 15 years ago, there was a site, Göbekli Tepe, that was discovered, and at first they thought it was just kind of like these giant rock structures, you know, and they started digging them out. And they discovered that these are like gigantic monoliths that are set up in a very, in much of the similar fashion that they set up Stonehenge. And but these things are were undeniably dated.
And where is this at?
This is in the area of like Afghanistan and Iran, kind of like where all that old like stuff is, like in Turkey. And there's several sites that are similar, but this one in particular site that was the thing interesting about it is they unearth these gigantic monoliths that are set up, and their carvings are very, very, very sophisticated. And by our current understanding or model of history, these would have been had to be created by hunter gatherer nomadic, you know,
tribes.
Like people that don't have a sophisticated understanding.
Almost Neanderthals.
Exactly. So first, 15,000 years ago, you know, they're not thinking that that we are, you know, having a constructed organization, like where we're like worshiping a god or like going to church or doing any sort of like organized religion or organized gatherings, you know. But these are dated back then, clearly. For the first time, we found something that predates the pyramids, you know what I mean? And when I say predate the pyramids, we've never been able to date the pyramids, because the only thing that they've actually dated was the actual carvings and the engravings and the markings on the pyramids, because they don't have the technology to actually date the actual stones. There's no way to do that, but they were able to date these stones by, you know, because they were buried there by the sediment and the rocks and everything that they were buried in. Now, here's the other crazy thing about it is there's not just one of them. There's like 50 of them in one site, and every single one was constructed individually, buried, and then they built a new one. Buried, built a new one, buried, built a new one every 100 years. So this one site was over 50 time capsules. And the interesting thing about it is that each one, as they find the older or more recent, is that the technology or the skill set, the craftsmanship of these monoliths, it doesn't improve over time. It gets worse over time. It dilapidates. Like, it's almost as if these people, you know, had a superior technology, and then they were trying to
replicate it?
Yeah.
Mimic it. Yeah.
Yeah, mimic it. But each time they reproduce, it would be kind of like, instead of going from the iPhone 4 to a 5 to a 6 to the 10, where all of a sudden we start digressing and we're rocking like
flip
phones.
Like if we had an iPhone 6 and then they took away all the technology, then the three of us had to try and build one on our own.
Exactly.
So what exactly does that mean? What are those things, and where did they come from?
Well, that's the conversation. And the hardline, what I would call them, almost like dogmatic historical scholars, that they're kind of stuck in what they've been taught and what their teachers have been taught and what their teachers have been taught for, you know, we're operating off of historical
misinformation in a way.
Yeah, that was established almost over 100 years ago. Like, this stuff really started coming, like, we really started exploring the country and coming up with all of our ideas about what happened as far as, like, the floods and the catastrophes in the 1800s, when we were basically, there was a mass migration from the East Coast to the West Coast. We kind of spanned the country, and that's what we know about, you know, areas like Montana and, like, you know, Northern Washington and all these, where there's these giant plains and huge hills, and still sparsely unpopulated relatively compared to the East Coast. And so there's a lot of interesting look at Utah and the mountains.
Nothing there.
Yeah, everything in Utah is crazy.
Yeah.
And all the sand dunes and the geography in Utah is mind-boggling, you know.
We were just out there. I did a show. We were searching for the lost gold of Butch Cassidy. And dude, it's
amazing.
It's Tatooine out there. It's Star Wars, complete barren nothing out there. And there's a lot of Mayan treasures buried there, because the Mayans came up through Utah. And then when that cat came, Jones, whatever it is, for Mormonism, you don't need financial gains, so no one searched for it. So now there's all this treasure up there just because of that reason. So, like, you're right, there is a lot of just complete mystery just in Utah alone.
And that goes to show you how little we've done. I mean, Joseph Smith went to Utah in the 1860s.
Right.
So when Salt Lake City was established, I mean, established, like, you know, what was that, 150 years ago. So we're living not... But we haven't really come to any great conclusions or assessments that necessarily grow upon what we've learned back then, you know?
So if you're talking about these monoliths, you mentioned Stonehenge, like, what do you guys think Stonehenge actually is? And how was it constructed?
I think
Aaron's got a big smile.
I think that the important thing is, I think the key point to all these questions is to acknowledge a little bit of we don't know. Because I think the problem comes into it is when we start thinking we know, mm-hmm. you know, because we don't know why they built that. And we don't know why they built we don't know how they built the pyramids, and we don't know why they built the pyramids.
Well, the things that we can assess, at least from our scientific model that we have now, is that these things align with constellations, with Orion's belt. And you find this from the pyramids to Stonehenge to, you know, the Hopi tribe in Arizona to different parts of, you know, East Asia and whatnot. So all these things seemingly line up with something happening in the cosmos, right?
And they also line up within the globe.
Right, like, within the actual structure of the Earth itself.
I mean, there's the pyramids in Mexico line up with the pyramids in Egypt, line up with Easter Island.
Almost on an equatorial line.
All on the same, like a linear...
Correct.
Yeah.
Really?
So Easter, yeah. If you draw a straight line from Easter Island to the pyramids, you're going to cross at least 10 other pyramids across the entire globe.
Wow.
There's an old line from my favorite author, Robert Anton Wilson. He says, if it happens once, it's coincidence. If it happens twice, it's happenstance. If it happens three times, it's conspiracy. So there's only so many times I think you can find evidence of these kind of artifacts or whatever, where you can look at it and say, well, that's weird, mm-hmm. and just kind of shrug it off. You know, to kind of tie this into, I'm not trying to pick on anybody, but like the New Earth Christian model, where it's almost like you don't even have to subscribe to that, but we kind of believe that in a sense, that we're like, humanity's like 15,000 years old. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing before that. It was Neanderthal, and it was, you know, these basic cognitive creatures that came before whatever we've evolved into. And we just kind of take that for what it is, because we found the evidence of that. But when we talk about these kind of structures and these things that we can find around the world that seem to have some kind of advanced technology comparable in a way to what we have now, in some sort of different paradigm or whatever, that would lend itself to think that maybe we aren't just as simple as, like, you know, the monkeys evolving or whatever, mm-hmm. that there was something predating our present knowledge. And if you look back at, you know, like universal history with like the destruction of, you know, the dinosaurs, for example, everything got wiped out, right? So let's say there was something else back then, and everything gets just totaled by a comet or whatever it might be, or the great floods. You know, all that information is somehow lost to us. So we're only left to pick up the puzzle pieces that are accessible at hand.
Mm.
You know, there's still all this information.
We don't know for sure.
You can't.
Like, no one really can answer how the dinosaurs became extinct. There's theories, but no
Correct.
One knows for sure.
Nobody
was saying it was all done before there's basic human knowledge and records and all that stuff.
And any great conspiracy involves information and disinformation. So, you know, I think the disinformation really coming with what Brian talked about in the beginning was like the history that we have that we're told. You know, it's really hard to sift through what's truth and what's not, what's fed to you mm-hmm. to kind of keep it complacent.
Disinformation, aka guessing,
yeah.
in a lot of ways,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Like when you're talking about the pyramids and how they were built, because I know, like, I think they've even tried a few times on different shows to build a pyramid, and it's pretty much impossible
they can't
to do.
It.
Do.
Yeah,
especially to the parameters that those were built, like almost perfection.
And the thing is those the like he was saying the actual like circumference of the if you add up the circumference of the base of the pyramid, it is, and then you multiply it times
it's some weird
pi. Number. No, it's the circumference of the planet Earth. Yeah,
say that again one more time.
So you multiply their the circumference of the base of the pyramid, and relative to the base of the other pyramids, and then there's a specific number that it's related to pi. It's not pi exactly, but it's related to pi, and it's the same. I can look it up, and it's the exact circumference of the Earth.
And similarly, from the top of the pyramid to the ground, there's another equation that works.
The radius,
the
radius
from the north to the south pole.
Were they all the same?
Every pyramid is different.
Oh, okay.
Every pyramid is not identical to each other, which shows you again that there's a reason for it, you know?
Hmm.
And so, you know, so we can trace back, you know, even when we try to kind of trace back our history, we can go back to, you know, Christ, and we know what was going on, you know, with the Romans back then, and that was, you know, around roughly the time of like Caesar. And then you go back another 500 years, and we're talking about Plato, you know, and anything before that is pretty much just like up in the air. But we start calling that stuff legend. We start saying, because then we're talking about great floods and Noah and Moses and
Enoch and all the,
yeah,
the,
and Atlantis,
the traditional Kabbalistic, you know, magic.
Right.
And so stuff, we just, you know, because we look at that stuff as like so far away ago, and they're talking about, you know, chariots of the gods and like all these things, but we have to understand that like this is an ancient people, and this is word of mouth verbatim happening over and over and over again. By the time we get the information, it's going
to
be
twisted. Campfire tales.
Exactly.
I whisper something to you, whisper to him. By the time it gets back to me, it's totally different. What I like about what we're discussing here is you guys are saying that these things maybe aren't possible to be built by humans, but it's not necessarily like an alien that dropped it down. Like, you guys are saying that we don't really know for sure, or do you have a theory on what it is?
I'm not saying that it's not possible to be done by humans.
Right.
I'm just saying that it's possible that an ancient civilization that we're not aware of, their understanding of their types of technology,
mm-hmm,
or their understanding of building and whatnot could have been completely different from our concept of it. We have technology that's based off, you know, hugely off electronics and electricity. And the infrastructure that we've built as our current race,
right,
could have been something totally different back then. But that's not to say that it couldn't have been just as advanced, if not more so.
If you ever look at like, if you even look at like a model of how many satellites we have around the Earth, it is insane. We have a junkyard of satellites currently around the Earth in space, and a lot of them when they die, they just die. And they're just, so we have this floating junkyard of satellites around our Earth. And I look at it kind of almost like we're in the industrial steampunk kind of version of technology, but our version of space. Because obviously you would imagine if there was a truly advanced civilization, they wouldn't be creating a junkyard of junk around their every single planet. Because after a while, you're going to eventually have to like clean it up.
But here's something that's interesting. When you talk about, you know, the Mayans and the whole civilization basically disappeared, there could be others that we don't even know of. There could have been some sort of technology that you could build the pyramids with that got lost,
sure,
and no one's ever been able to figure it out because the whole system was gone.
100%, you know.
Eradicated.
And the thing is so what you would have in that instance is you would have these great monolithic structures that would survive a catastrophe, and then you would have a people that would have tales, legends of like how these things were created, then they would just kind of take it over. Then you end up with the Egyptian dynasty. People that had this, almost they inherited it, you know,
almost as keepers of the, that information to be handed down to.
Which goes back all the way down to Plato when
mentioned Plato a couple times with the significance.
So Plato traveled to Egypt and spoke to this guy Solon, and Solon is the one that told him all about Atlantis, and Solon got his information from an ancient Egyptian priest back in those times. So this Egyptian priest, which carried this, you know, sacred knowledge that they've been carrying for tens of thousands of years, you know, entrusted Plato with this information. That's how Plato came up with the story of Atlantis. A lot of people look at it like a story, but Plato never claimed it as a story. Plato claimed it as like
the city that was sunken under the sea.
Well, that's our modern translation. Yeah, the great sunken city of Atlantis. But if you just look at it from a more logical perspective, it's not just a city, but it would be an entire civilization wiped out by water, by a flood, you know? Because if basically 12,000 years ago, 12,800 years ago, there was a giant flood, and there's no way that's historical fact. And in that time, which is what we were talking about, all the great mega mammals, 75% of them went extinct. We used to have crazy giant beavers the size of rhinoceros, horses the size of giraffe, I mean ostriches that are like, you know, like
giant birds,
12 feet tall, huge giant birds,
armadillos.
75% of them wiped off, you know, including the mastodons. And in our current model of history, we claim that as like, okay, well, there was a flood and the ones that survived were hunted away into extinction by nomadic hunter-gatherer humans, because we were not smart enough to like use their furs as coats, and we were just animals back then, as far as they're concerned, as far as history is concerned. But
Is there proof of that there was actually Neanderthal? I like how you pronounce it properly, Neanderthals and mammoths at the same time frame?
Oh, absolutely.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, there's entire gigantic graveyards of woolly mammoth bones that were discovered in the late 1800s that span all the way from North Dakota to Montana. Mm-hmm. And you can find these pictures online where they're these black and white pictures of just literally tens of thousands of woolly mammoth carcasses. And they're claiming that those were hunted by hunter-gatherers, because if they don't claim that, then they have to rewrite their version of like what really when that flood was and what the consequences of that flood were and how that flood even happened.
And this model assumes that those hunter-gatherers just massacred these beasts. Like, we're just going to kill them all. Which even from a simple mindset makes no sense. Why would you just kill all of them?
Yeah.
You know, you would think if they're hunter-gatherers, they're worried, if they're on that low of a cognitive level, they're worried about survival and survival only. So that means food, shelter, protection. Why would you just massacre a species?
Well, not to mention, if you're talking about woolly mammoths, which were quite large animals, and what are they using for weapons back in those days?
Of course.
Spears?
Yeah, exactly.
How many spears do you have to throw to kill one woolly mammoth? Right. Never mind, how many are we talking about? Hundreds? Yeah. Thousands?
Exactly.
How many woolly mammoths are we talking about?
Oh, tens of tens of thousands.
Okay, so yeah, tens and tens of thousands of woolly mammoths killed by primitive men seems a little bit strange. It's the same thing with dinosaurs. Like I said, like Slash and I are big dinosaur aficionados. And we talk about them. How did the dinosaurs extinct? Well, maybe there's some kind of a disease or maybe something went down. But no one really knows for sure.
Well, there's this – so if you dig down into the sediment around that area, it shows that clearly around that time period that we're talking about, 12,800 years ago, there's this large impacted level of soot, of massive black thick layer within
it's
the
like
sediment.
A ring.
It's
like,
yeah,
like,
exactly.
Like a layer.
And it's a very clear layer. And below that layer, you have all the bones of these gigantic mega mammals. And above it, you only have the remaining. So obviously, there was some sort of catastrophe that caused all the soot. So the way that soot would be able to would come down, you would have to have an impact crater large enough to kick up, you know, tons and tons and tons of earth that's literally lava hot, and then this stuff is just sprinkling down over a huge large area and causing gigantic fires like that would span, you know, thousands of miles, you know. And it's on a scale so big that we can't even comprehend, of just like, imagine just everything from Seattle to Michigan on fire at one time, in an instant of one mass, and in a circumference that goes all the way down,
one mass extinction.
Yeah.
And then not to mention, after, you know, you have the fire raining down, but as it gets higher and higher into the atmosphere, it cools down, it turns and freezes, and then covers everything out, which is what you get, you know, that would create those rings that we're talking
with
about
the ice, you know, age, maybe.
Yeah.
So you're saying that there was a comet that hit the earth that started, or comets?
Well, that's the one, that's the thing that isn't widely acknowledged right now. They do acknowledge the flood. They do acknowledge the mass extinction. They do acknowledge the cooling down and the raising of temperature. All that, they just don't want to acknowledge the comet, because there's back in those times when they were establishing these theories, there was two camps, and there was like science versus the religious, and the religious tended to focus a lot on catastrophism, you know, basically like the idea of like there was a great flood and there was a great fire and there was a great and their explanation for all these things were because it was God, you know. Mm-hmm. And science at the time was rightfully so combating these ideas,
theories, ideas, hypotheses.
Yeah, well, more superstitions.
Gotcha.
Superstitions and folklore. They were combating these, like, the mysticism, you know, and which they should do. But then what ended up happening is they actually kind of ended up taking a hard line approach of never really accepting those things or digging into them and, okay, well, how could that happen, you know, which it clearly did. I mean, there's if you go into that book we were talking about, Fingerprints of the Gods and Magicians of the Gods by Graham Hancock, you know, they show pictures, aerial pictures, of areas of Montana through Idaho through Washington, where you see very clearly gigantic scrapes, you know, like across the entire land that span hundreds of miles. And we see that every day. Like if we're driving from California to Arizona, you see these gigantic, huge mesas that just, you just have this very like mountain, and all of a sudden you just got like a flat top for hundreds of miles, and then it dips down, and you would have to imagine it like on such a huge scale, water rushing, you know, that's you know, a half a mile high, and you know, just gushing all the way from Texas all the way to California. What that looks like when it starts slowing down and dying down is it's just like a puddle in your backyard, and everything that's above the water gets like shaved off, and everything below the water kind of remains ridge.
So let me ask you this: if you're talking about going back to the Great Fire and how they don't acknowledge it, why? Why wouldn't history not acknowledge that? Or historians, shall we say?
Well, you know, once you have an established narrative, it takes a lot for you to break out of it. You know,
let's not forget that even scientists are prideful, like anyone. You
know? That is a huge part of it.
Nobody wants to say they're wrong, and you know, and this ties into not only science but religion as well. And I don't think the two are separate. I think the two can be reconciled, but we can get into that later or whatever.
Yeah.
But to admit that you were at fault, no human wants to do that.
That's hundreds of years.
Thousands, probably.
Yeah.
You know, we can go back to, you know, the early Catholic Church and some of the things that happened there where, you know, still now 2,000 years later, we don't want to say, you know, we screwed up. Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, it ties into
science isn't innocent of that either.
But it's tied into politics, and it's tied into, money. You know, because basically everything eventually gets sponsored, and right now a lot of the science community, which has everything, seems to be over the past 20 years become very, very polarized left and right. You know. And so you have this idea where we are very and we should be worried about, like, you know, global warming and humans' impact on all these things. But then if you subscribe to that theory, you either subscribe to the theory that humans are causing this huge problem on the Earth, and we're like the number one cause, mm-hmm. and these things are our fault, and unless we lower our emissions, we're gonna like kill ourselves. And you have the other version that just says, the other side that says, well, that's bullshit. And those are your two sides, and you can't be down the middle, because so the minute you start saying, well, maybe there's these other gigantic things that have much, much larger impact on the Earth than humans ever could.
What, like in an infinite universe?
Yeah. That doesn't mean that we all of a sudden should all start driving Hummers. No, let's still like drive electric cars, because that's more efficient, and we're taking care of our Earth that we live in. But you can't say both, because it's like they like to push the narrative that like humans, we are these creatures that if we don't control you and tell you what to do, look what you did back then. You wiped out all the woolly mammoths, and then you put lead in your paint, and then now you're like driving, you know, like fuel inefficient vehicles.
And that's fueled by fear.
Yeah, and we should definitely take care of that stuff, but it's almost like the intention in which it's coming from isn't from a loving, hey, let's do the right thing place. It's a fear-based, like, do this or you will die.
Let's use a really simple metaphor that I can speak from experience. So I'm a smoker, right?
Right.
And smoking's bad. I can admit that. However, there's people that smoke their whole lives and don't die of lung cancer, right? So you could use that argument. Well, see, that guy smoked till he was 95 and he was fine. Now, that's not to say that smoking's not bad. It is bad. So saying like the human race, like putting out emissions and causing toxicity to the earth is certainly a part of it. But it doesn't have to just be one or the other. It doesn't have to be humans' fault. It doesn't have to be the cosmos' fault. Maybe it's like, oh, I don't know, kind of both.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe we're a small little piece of this infinite little thing.
You mentioned
happening.
Infinite universe. What do you mean by that?
Well, space is expanding. We don't have an end to it yet.
Mm-hmm. And
maybe that's, you know, again, our flawed perspective or our limited perspective being these little specks of conscious life here.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't see to the end of the universe yet.
Right.
And it seems to be growing according to quantum physics. So.
And accelerating.
We can hardly get off of our planet.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
We like to think, we've always liked to think that we are
the center of the universe.
The most advanced. I mean, humans are far fetched to name anything superior to ourselves.
Mm.
You know, like how, like we can't, I don't think any, unless you find some, you know, some Eckhart Tolle guy, like name something that's superior to us even on Earth, you know.
Top do of the food chain,
you know, do we got
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. So what are you saying? Are you saying, do you think there's other species, other living?
You know, I have my own species. Idea about that. My idea about that is that it's next to impossible for an inferior creature to truly acknowledge a superior creature to itself. I feel that, like, if there was a fly in here right now, you know, or an ant, that those creatures are not by ego not able to recognize me and understand that I have, you know, 5,000 unread emails on my phone, and like later on today I'll be like, you know, downloading something off of Dropbox and you're going to upload this podcast onto your, I mean, it's just beyond their scope of understanding, you know what I mean? Right. The most that I can interact with that ant is like spitting a loogie on it, and it's just all of a sudden it's stuck in my loogie, and
it's gross.
It's raining. Oh God, the gods, the gods must be crazy. You know what I mean?
Loogie of the gods.
Yeah. And so, like, by that same logic, you know, we endure these horrible tornadoes and these hurricanes and these tidal waves, and we have earthquakes, and
and it's God mad at us because we voted for Trump,
and let's stick little.
That was a great theory, by the way.
I was livid when I was reading that. Was oh, Florida one. Deserved it because they voted for Trump.
Is we're
oh,
sticking
come on.
Little tiny, like, you know, electronic devices, like, you know, skimming the surface of the earth, trying to like measure, well, when's the next, you know, earthquake gonna come, you know? But, you know, for all we know, water, you know, just the singular mass of water that covers more than half of the earth could be a living, alive organism, like way farther advanced than we could ever truly acknowledge. And the water, we're born within water, we die within water. Water is a part of us. We are mostly water. But could we ever have the foresight to say, oh, well, water is alive? Because we just don't.
We just don't understand it, yeah.
Yeah.
So many things to discuss here, so much food for thought. But what are other examples of revisionist history do you have of humans just accepting something because that's the way it is? I want to keep talking about some of those things. But first, I want to say a quick word about Geico. Everybody's got a to-do list. Drop off the dry cleaning, pick up some milk, listen to Talk is Jericho. But here's an idea. Let's save hundreds of dollars on car insurance to that list. And the good thing is you don't have to drop off or pick up anything. All you got to do is go to geico.com. And in 15 minutes, you could be saving 15% or more on car insurance. What? Extra money in your pocket? Yeah, boy. It might just be the most rewarding to-do you do today. Go to geico.com.
I'm Dane Lobb. I'm a public safety specialist with PG&E. If you're in your home or business and you smell gas, your first step is to get out. Travel to a safe distance until you can't smell the gas anymore, and then call 911. The first responders will come out and they'll make it safe for you and your community.
Buddy the Elf, what's your favorite color?
Talk is Jericho.
What other examples do you have of kind of this revisionist history of just accepting things because that's just the way it is?
I want to go back to something you brought up earlier about, you know, Plato going to Egypt and talking to their...
Now, Plato is a Greek philosopher?
Correct.
Yes. Correct. Okay, so he goes so
there
to
was,
Egypt.
There's Plato, there's Pythagoras was back from his era too, yeah. And he was into all sorts of crazy stuff. But so when they talk about going back to Egypt and meeting, you know, the Egyptian priesthood, basically, which is their secret initiates or whatever, you start to see these names pop up like Thoth from their lineage or whatever. But then you start to see these names pop up in almost every culture worldwide under different names, but they serve the same purpose, right? So you'll see it as Hermes Trismegistus, and you'll see it as Abraham or Solomon in the Jewish history. Mm. But you also see it in Lao Tzu from China, from the Taoist. And all these people serve the same purpose. I had somebody tell me years ago that at the time that Jesus Christ wasn't Jesus' name. He was Jesus of Nazareth. And Christ is a surname given to someone who is an anointed one or an enlightened one. And at the time of Jesus, there were 23 Christs on the planet.
Hmm.
So it just kind of depends who you ask. But so you start seeing, right, you have like the flood story from the Bible. And you have that same flood story appearing all throughout ancient culture. You have this fiery earth theory popping up all over ancient culture in cultures that really didn't have any means by which to communicate with one another. theoretically, you know, as far as we know, the Mayans never talked to the Greeks,
right.
never talked to the Egyptians, never talked to the Japanese or the Chinese. But again, how are all these little synchronicities with, like we were talking with the placement of these monolithic structures and whatnot, and all of these similar tales happening? It seems like everyone dogmatized those universal ideas or these stories.
Yeah.
They dogmatized them in their own culture, and that's what bred things like religion, organized religion.
Mm.
And then that becomes, as Brian pointed out earlier, monetized and becomes bureaucratic. So one of, you know, going back to like the time of Jesus up until St. Augustine, when the church really kind of like hunkered down and said, you know, they had the whole meeting where they canonized what books would be in the Bible, what
right.
books were not. And then, you know, we find the Nag Hammadi, how do you say that? The Egyptian library we found back in the 30s.
I have to look it up. I can't pronounce it yet.
But that's where we found like all the Gnostic Gospels of Thomas and the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, and all these things were just like crushed by the church because they went against the idea of having people, the church, the priest, the Pope, and then God. So you needed a pathway to go through these things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is where initiatic traditions come in to play, and you can name drop the Illuminati or the Masons or whatever you want to do, or even the triads of China, the Tong, the mafia of China goes way back to you know, the plum flower groups of early ancient times. These are all similar, almost identical groups
in different parts of the world,
right? And then the bureaucratic process of religion said that you had to go through them for salvation. And you find this all over world religion, where any of the actual, like, the Gnostic people or the people looking for knowledge, experiential knowledge of God, which was what Plato was looking for, Pythagoras was looking for, the Taoists were looking for, was this direct communion to something bigger, was just snuffed because it wasn't monetizable. You couldn't make money off it. And if you can't monetize it, you can't control people.
And we can relate to that now by basically saying, look, like, the establishment will gain power and will gain control, and a good idea will turn bad, which we can clearly see with the Constitution and politics. And nowadays, in 200 years, we went from being the people that rebelled against the establishment, creating our own thing, and now we're in a position again where, by just the very first couple of lines of the Bill of Rights, we would need to do it all over again right now for the state of the union, if you know that you would have it today. So, you know, like Aaron was saying, like at the time where when Jesus was alive, you know, and he lived, he did his thing, and then like 500 years later, basically what was the instrument of his death becomes the thing that they put on top of every single building. I mean, like, if that's not a play on reverse psychology and manipulation, that would basically be like if JFK, you know, if there was a huge resurgence of American patriotism that, like, revolted against the establishment and we held JFK as our leader, but then once the establishment takes hold again, we're sticking AK-47s and rifles on the top of every building just to remember, hey, you know, JFK died for your sins, so you don't have to. You know, like, it's just like it keeps the population under control.
Now, when we were talking about this, I mentioned to you, Aaron, that we were going to talk about this, and you showed me a tattoo on your arm of what is it that you showed me? What is that symbol?
The eye and the pyramid. I got two of them.
And what does that mean? Yes, I surrounded by pyramid.
By a triangle, yeah. I mean, it has a lot of meanings throughout a lot of different cultures. One could be the all-seeing eye of God. Another interpretation of it can be the eye representing consciousness.
Yes, both have them.
We have all of the same tattoos, and that wasn't planned. It's very
really?
Like, yeah, we can get into
just
that.
Just quickly, how long have you guys known each other?
8 years.
But were you both into this when you met?
Well, when we first met, he came into my bedroom and he saw my book collection and he started naming off books that he had that were my same books. And I was like, I've never met anyone in my life.
And nor have I. Both you guys are so into this. It's crazy. That talk about happenstance right there, right?
Yeah.
I call it conspiracy.
He's like, you have we always joke, like, you have Book of Law, I have Book of Law. You have Pale White Horse, I have Pale White Horse. And then we get, and then when we wrote Anonymous,
we're like,
you have
the other Bible from all the Gnostic Gospels?
Oh, yeah.
Huh, interesting. You read the Gospel of Thomas too, and drink from my mouth, and you will be as I am? Mm. Interesting.
Wow, so hold on a second. Then we're still talking about the Eye in the Pyramid. What's the Gospel of Thomas? That's a whole different thing.
The Gospel of Thomas was one of the
Gnostic.
The Gnostic text found in that Egyptian library that I can't remember the name of.
What does Gnostic mean?
Gnostic means gnosis. It means knowledge, but not knowledge like I read a book. It's experiential knowledge. Mm. It's like
it's the opposite of agnostic. So agnostic means I don't know. Gnostic means I know.
So like you can read in a book, I guess, what it's like to be punched in the face,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's a certain type of knowledge. But then I could punch you in the face, and now you know what
great
that's knowledge.
Great analogy.
So in that way, it means to know God, and to know God in the non. I mean, we might be throwing around the word God here a lot, you know. And into someone that's not like super into all this, you know. We were all raised in different, you know, like situations. Some people are raised completely away from that. Some people are raised in a very structured, you know, religious. You know, I had, and the thing that for me at a my formative teenage years, I had several bad acid trips. I OD'd. I died. I kind of had all these like weird things happen in my life that I walked out of it in my early 20s, very with that. Before I even found a word for it, Gnostic would be the word for it, because I crossed the veil. I came near the back multiple times, and I knew that, like, okay, well, I kind of see where all these religions are going with this thing, but that's definitely not it. I felt this thing, I touched this thing, whatever it is, this eternal, infinite place where your consciousness can go, and that people could try to explain, but it's really hard to.
There's been scientific documentation of this stuff as well as more, I guess, mystical. Kind of interpretation. So you can go to Timothy Leary and look at his LSD research. Mm-hmm. And he has this thing, this model called the 8 circuits of consciousness. And basically, most humans operate on the base 4, which is the oral, approach, avoid, fight or flight, the anal, which is territorial, control or submit. Then you have the semantic level, which is symbolism and language and how we communicate. And then there's the sexual or moral code, which is, you know, basically ethics. How we deal with sexuality, how we deal with emotional interactions on a deeper level. That's where most people stop evolving. And then you have the fifth level, which he basically called kind of like the Zen Buddhist equivalent of Nirvana, where you have this euphoric kind of thing, which Thomas Aquinas was a saint in the Catholic Church who experienced it, called the ecstasy, where they basically commune with God, but still as their self, in a sense. Like the ego strips away, sort of, but it's still you experiencing God. And then there's three more that go up, eventually getting to what he talks about, metaprogramming, where you can go back and rewire those earlier circuits. So you can consciously rewire your approach, avoid, or your dominate, submissive qualities by just kind of reworking almost your DNA, in a sense. And the highest level of that he called God consciousness, or universal consciousness, where you, what Brian's talking about, he said that everybody who takes LSD eventually has at least one moment where they get to that place. And I, too, tripped on LSD quite a few times. And I can say for sure there was always some moment where there was this profound connection to something I can't describe. And you can't, when you come back, you always kind of lose most of it.
It's right,
there.
Right.
But
it's like a dream where you wake up and you can't remember exactly what you're talking about.
It's exactly
about.
Basically, like everything he, you know, we're talking about here sounds very like, oh wow, that's such a cool, crazy idea, but like this is essentially the Kabbalah, and this is the stuff right. that Jesus was learning about and teaching about back in those days. Mary, his mother Mary, was a high priestess in the Essian tradition, which is like, I mean, if you go to any school scholar, you know, I mean, you can find that, you know. And they were the esoteric Gnostic spiritualists at the time.
And so, and you can find the same stuff in Zen Buddhism. I have this book called Zen in the Brain. It was Yeah, I have that.
Yeah, we're talking symbol to tattooed all over. Yeah,
yeah, it's everywhere.
Aaron's got the same one. But there's also like there's a classic big gap between Jesus as a child and Jesus as a 33-year-old man,
saying that he went to, you know, possibly Asia and studied with them. So the Zen Buddhist would claim that you can chemically alter your own consciousness through deep meditation. So you don't need, basically, like any kind of drug in that sense is like an accelerator to that process. And that's why it's so hard to keep a hold of those experiences, because you're literally putting something in that triggers those experiences. Whereas if you're doing it through the very slow, you know, almost torturous methods of the Taoists or the Zen Buddhists,
meaning meditation.
Yeah. And
so LSD will get you there faster, but you'll lose it. Whereas meditation will take longer, but you can keep it longer in theory. Yeah.
Well, there's so, like you mentioned the gap in history with Jesus is like, first of all, that's the gap of the history of the established people that wanted to put out the narrative that they wanted to put out. I mean, like we're talking about that, like, a lot of the plant-based medicines that they were using back there. I mean, one of the most powerful plants that's throughout the Bible and all old writings is acacia. They from the burning bush of when Moses found the Ten Commandments, all the way through Masonic ritual, which uses the acacia to denote when
acacia's a plant.
Yeah, it's a plant, and when Hiram Abiff was murdered at the Temple of Solomon, they buried him with an acacia plant by his head, because it's an evergreen and it's meant to symbolize that your soul will live on forever. But it's also just happens to be, you know, hallucinogenic when you smoke it. So this is just, and if Moses found a burning bush. Of a bush that's hallucinogenic when you smoke it. I mean, these are just things you kind of have to like put one in
marijuana
and one together.
Bush or something.
Yeah, right. And maybe that's not necessarily what it literally was, because a lot of these things should never be interpreted literally. But the idea of like, how are you going to communicate that if it's a 1500-year-old story before even the time of Christ? Mm-hmm. How are you gonna like let the people know that, okay, we're trying to like tell. You know, first of all, how much communication can change over hundreds of years, let alone thousands of years? You know, they're trying to communicate these sophisticated thoughts, you know? And so that's how you explain it.
There's even stories from the Gnostic texts that talk about how the communion, the sacrament, was actually a certain type of mushroom that was hallucinogenic. So that when Jesus and his disciples were breaking bread, they were eating hallucinogenic mushrooms. And they were tripping. And again, like, those types of drugs can also foster those kind of consciousness experiences that are kind of beyond the five senses that we, you know, utilize.
That we know of, right?
Right.
And what does the eye in the pyramid signify, that you guys, the tattoo we were talking about?
Well, I mean, traditionally, it is meant to be the all-seeing eye of God, where it's basically saying that we are all united as humanity under one higher consciousness. And you guys are looking at that consciousness as something. I think a big problem is that we look at that consciousness as something separate from us. Like, oh, there's this thing looking down on us, where I think my understanding of it has evolved to the point where I look at it like that is the manifestation of our collection, of our collective consciousness.
Which Carl Jung called the Akashic Records.
Yeah. It's us. It's just us. It's all of us combined. It's like, imagine if we can get all of humans looking up at a mirror at the same time, and that sight looking back down on us, that's what God is, you know.
As Thomas Aquinas kind of labeled it, he defined God as the one thing that is just beyond human understanding. So the biggest thing that as humans we can kind of comprehend mentally is infinity, right? Even if we can even wrap our head around what that really
means. It
goes
on forever, yeah.
So God is one step beyond that. Was his definition of it, which I love.
And that was the Gospel of Thomas. It's not a lost gospel from the Bible. It's a completely different.
No, it is a lost
gospel. So there's actually the lost books of the
correct.
Bible.
Yeah. There's a book you can order online called The Other Bible, and it has
all of them,
plus like the writings of the Hermetic traditions, a lot of other crazy stuff. I mean, there's like baby gospels of Jesus that were found. And it's Nag Hammadi, I remember how to say it.
So why, you know, once again, the question of why would those books not be included in the typical King James Bible?
Because they're saying to the people that they're talking about the Gnostic experience of being, like what Brian just said, that the entirety of humanity, of our conscious being, is already a part of it. We've just kind of lost sight of it. Whereas the church had to have this kind of hierarchical system, so that you have to go to the priest to absolve your sin. You have to go to confession.
Well, there's a clear separation from what the church is and what the church was back in those times versus the text that they wrote their Bible from. You know, like, they wrote their Bible from a collection. They basically had a library of books. You know, let's just imagine it to be hundreds and hundreds of books and these things back in those times they were handwritten.
Sure.
You know, so they go and they're like, we're going to pick these 40. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And anything that doesn't fit with the narrative that they're trying to establish they're not going to include, obviously, you know?
It's like you have to edit a movie to tell the story that you want to tell.
Exactly.
So it's like deleted scenes.
Yeah. And very much like converting a book to a movie. How much detail do we always lose in that sense?
Right. Great point. I just saw that you sent me a text of something you did before. Are you a Freemason?
Yes.
Gotcha. Now, I don't even know if you can talk about what is Freemason.
Freemason.
Heard about it for so much. You mentioned it earlier, but what exactly is
Freemason?
Freemason is
one of the older fraternities that have been passed down orally over the past, several hundred years, that can be traced back with roots. They back to Solomon and Hiram Abiff, and mm-hmm. that's where a lot of it. It's basically. Long time ago, in those times, ancient stonemasons were the only people that really traveled. A lot of people were born, they born, lived, and died in their little tiny town.
Right.
Yeah, and there was never, it didn't make sense for them to travel. It served no purpose. The certain people that did travel, there was actually two groups of people that traveled, and it was the stonemasons and it was the artists and the musicians, you know? And so
masons would have to travel to build
cities. It was a very specific skill set, and they were very well paid. So it was very common for people to impersonate that they were a skilled craftsman, because they would try to walk on the site, and these sites would hire hundreds and hundreds of workers. And so they developed a system of grips, signs, handshakes, secret passwords to acknowledge each other if two people had never met. How are you going to know? Because if one thing goes wrong when you're building a giant cathedral, if it's not square, if it's not level, if it's not plumb, the building's going to fall down. And that happens a lot, mm-hmm. you know? And so they took it real serious. And the punishments were, you could be punished with death. You can get your hand cut off, get your tongue cut out if you impersonated it, because they were just trying to get their master mason wages,
which they weren't.
And so basically over hundreds of years, the society grew and started people that were not physical stonemasons that worked with their hands, but intellectual, creative types, scientists and philosophers, and teachers, they started offering them basically honorary acceptance into them, and then that became free and accepted masons. And so as the stonemason part of it started kind of like fading away, it became the free and accepted masons, and that was a very big, group
society
around the time when they first started coming from Europe to America
and even prior to that, the fact that they were traveling, they were coming in contact with all of these different cultures we kind of touched on earlier, as far as like the Muslim cultures and meeting their higher priests, where mm-hmm. they're more Gnostic. They have the Sufis are kind of the Gnostic sect of Islam.
Yeah, you
and
hear
Kabbalists in Judaism and the Gnostics in Christianity and the Hermetics in Egypt and whatnot. So they would be exposed to all these different things because they were the ones traveling, and they started seeing those similarities, which is why they communed with those people. But if they go back to their homeland and they start talking about this, now it's heresy. If you go back to a Christian nation, you said, I met with the Muslims and they have these really cool ideas that are kind of similar to ours. Well, didn't go over.
On the other hand.
Yeah.
What does a Freemason mean in this day and age? Is it just a club, or do you get studies?
It's very similar, there's...
Do you have meetings?
There's meetings, like we have, I'm in North Hollywood and we have, a stated meeting every month.
What do you discuss?
you know, well, we socially, we discuss everything. We discuss this stuff. We discuss just,
music,
you know, yeah, within
culture,
yeah, within any group of people, you're going to have the people that kind of like, there's definitely the people that love talking about the esoteric spiritual principles and expanding your mind. There's like other places you can go to for mm-hmm. that. You know, if you're into that, you know, you might want to, you know, investigate the Scottish Rite and get into like 32nd degree and go that route. You know, if you're more into the ritualistic kind of historical splinter, you might want to investigate, you know, the York Rite and then like the Knights Templar.
It's basically a group of like-minded people that just like to discuss the mysteries of history, basically.
Yes. Yeah. You know, because at a certain age, you know, when you're done with college or high school or whatever, you're kind of like left onto your own to figure out what you want to figure out. And it's real nice to find a group of like-minded, well-educated, successful men for you to kind of feed off each other's energy, you know, and you, not everyone is as lucky open. To be in a creative circle of people like, you know, I mean, I just from us being in a band, we get to work with these amazingly talented producers and these, you know, very business minded, you know, sharp, yeah, like managers and lawyers and everything that kind of all the people who come into contact with that, you know, in this world and in your profession. Mm-hmm. I mean, we get it really trigger something like, wow, like I could really be successful in life if I start modeling, you know, these people's work ethic and implement this in my life, you know. And so people like us are just kind of gravitate towards it, you mm-hmm. know. And
do you incorporate a lot of this stuff into your music lyrically? Or
yeah, there's definitely, I mean, there's references all over from, you know, all sorts of religious work and really this conversation in general. You know, I mean, we are all the light of the sun and the moon. Well, yeah, this stuff's everywhere.
You're working on a trilogy. You have a trilogy. The first two of the records are all they're related, and then they're doing a third. Is that correct?
Correct.
From what I understand.
So you have Lux was the first record, meaning light. Mm-hmm. As you're born, that's the first light you see. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a birth record, dealing with that kind of time period and of coming of age, and really like going even back to those four circuits of consciousness, as we're kind of conditioned over the, you know, you get your first two really up until about the age of seven, is really, you know, The approach of void, the first circuit is imprinted as soon as you're born. And it really comes down to, do you get the mother's teat or not? Mm. If you get the mother's teat, you're probably programmed for approach. Because that first thing you experience is nourishment from the mother, right? For example, I was adopted. When I was born, I was put in, you know, in an incubator. Mm. And tested for 3 weeks because I had albinism. They thought I was blind. They thought I was deaf. They thought I was mute. They thought I was retarded. Turns out none of those things are true. Mm-hmm. But I absolutely have an avoidant personality to a lot of degrees. And I have an oral I have an oral fixation. I smoke. I always have something to drink. Mm. You know what I mean? I'm constantly fidgety.
Interesting.
That's just the way I was wired. So going back to the, you know, to talking about the higher levels of consciousness to try to reprogram that. And you can achieve that through martial arts, and then that the deep like qigong meditation stuff. You can, there's all sorts of methodologies to go about it. But so point being, by the time you're seven, you really have, you know, when you're a toddler, you start really learning how to manipulate your parents. Well, I want a cookie. Well, it's not time for a cookie. Well, what can I do to get a cookie? And that's where you start learning how to manipulate socially, and that ties into, you know, are you an aggressive kind of person? Are you going to like intimidate to get what you want, or are you going to be the poor me and like cry because what I really want the cookie? And all of those kind of personality traits eventually form what you are as an adult, right? And then as you get past 7 years old, then you start really learning language and symbolism. You start learning how the alphabet or other languages that might be more pictograph, like Chinese or Japanese or something like that, how those influence the way that your brain functions. You know, et cetera, et cetera, down the road. Yeah.
You mentioned albinism, so aka essentially albino. That's the word.
That's the term.
Is that a correct word?
The politically correct term is a person with albinism. The scientific term for the genetic condition is albinism. Supposedly,
so person with albinism.
Yeah, I'm an albino. Let's just call a spade a spade.
But I mean, like when I have, you know, like some of my friends that I've been on before in the past that are little people, like midget. It's not the politically correct word,
right?
But they're like, yeah, I'm a midget. Fuck it.
Yeah, that's where I'm at. I don't care. I'm an albino. So you know?
What does that What does that, like, explain that? Like, what does that mean?
So it's a recessive gene trait that's inherited by the child. It has to be carried in a recessive fashion by both the mother and the father. So you can have that part of your DNA code, but if it's not recessive, like let's say I was a chick and Brian is Brian and we mated, okay, just because you're in the room. And let's say I have that gene and it's recessively activated and he has the gene, but it's not, kid won't be albino.
Gotcha.
If we both share that recessive trait, there's a possibility of the kid being albino. That's not even to say that it's true. I've met plenty of people who, you know, have albinism or whatever, and like they have it, and then the middle kid doesn't, and then the third kid does. Mm. And I've met kids that all of them have it in the family. You know what I mean? So it's really kind of a crapshoot in a sense. Basically, what it does is it affects the development of pigment and melanin in the skin. So that's why there's no color, there's no tanning.
White hair, white skin.
It affects the eyesight due to the fact that the retina is partially pigmented. So the part of the retina that controls 20/20 to 20/70 vision is basically null.
You wear glasses all the time, but you don't wear glasses on stage, do you?
No, I'm blind as a bat.
So you literally can't see.
I mean, I can see, but it's very difficult for me to explain to someone who has good vision because I've never had it. So gotcha. I don't have a reference point.
I understand.
To me, I see as good as I've ever seen.
Right. With your glasses on, it's clearer.
For me. But yeah, then, yeah. You know, we could be walking down the street and be like, oh, check out that. And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, can you drive?
No.
Okay, gotcha.
I did for 5 years when I was like 18 to 23. My vision progressively got better as a kid. Up until I hit about my mid-20s where the body really stops growing.
Regresses, gotcha.
And then it was like, I could still do it. I just, you know, I'm a city dweller.
Mm-hmm.
I've lived in Chicago, Los Angeles, Las Vegas.
Yeah.
I don't want to mess with it. If I lived in the country, I'd totally drive.
Yeah.
I'm an excellent driver. Drove 5 years, no tickets, no accidents, and I put on probably 100,000 miles of drive time. So, excellent driver.
Yeah.
Definitely, yeah.
More than I could say.
I'm a better driver than Brian. No offense.
But what about, like, you mentioned, like, white skin? Like, could you ever get a tan?
Nope.
Or would you just sunburn?
Like, it's just burn.
Gotcha.
And that's another interesting thing, though, too. So I started doing traditional Chinese kung fu in my teens. And
I noticed you always wear, like, the Chinese
always.
Kind of
yeah,
shirt.
Yeah, yeah.
And, yeah. What's that called?
I don't remember.
A Chinese shirt.
A Chinese shirt, yeah. Thanks, Amazon and Brian. But there's a part of the Qigong that, you know, they talk about energy or chi or whatever and how you can move that throughout
sure,
the body
sure, sure,
in traditional
sure.
Chinese medicine. There is one thing called guardian qi, which is really affected by, it starts with the lungs and the large intestine. Those organs affect the skin. So what I noticed when I was in my late teens, when I was really, really starting to get into this stuff, like heavy, and I was living with my sifu, with my teacher, and I was training like 6-7 days a week, 8 hours a day, living in Ventura, California, on the beach, I would go to the beach and train by myself, and I would never get burned. Mm. As a kid, though, I was a lobster, and peeling all the time. Like, I had to absolutely wear sunscreen at all times. Mm. And that's not the case anymore. And I found that very interesting. I have to chalk it up to that, in a sense. And like you said, you know, I go on stage without glasses. I can't see. If I hadn't done the martial arts for as long as I have, I wouldn't have the spatial awareness that I have. Mm. That's really what it taught me. I don't claim to be a fighter by any means. I haven't fought in 20 years. Mm-hmm. I like to keep it that way.
Yeah.
You know, unless you want to hop in the ring.
Hell no, man. Not with you.
Not with you. Thanks. But, you know, all of that stuff kind of influenced it as to how I can function the way that I do. I've met hundreds of people with albinism. And it's like a sliding scale. Like, some people are way more pale than I am and have way worse vision than I do and are way less functional, in a sense. And I've met people who are on the opposite end where they, you know, I don't look totally dark. I could pass as an Irish person in a sense, you know, but I know albinos that do drive.
But you also kind of like, not, I don't know if paraded is the word, but you almost like you have a big white beard. You wear white on stage. You're almost sort of like, yes, this is me. And
I like magicians, man. You know, going back to the thing with Thoth and how it kind of pops up in all these different cultures, the kind of ancient, the old English version of it is Mithras, which is Merlin. So I grew up, like, loving magic and loving, like, wizards and shit.
Yeah.
I mean, my beard right now is short in comparison, because Brian always makes me cut it. He says I don't look good.
Just as we wind down here, do you think that this revisionist history will continue? Do you think there'll ever be a time when kind of the doors are open? Because I'm sure there's a lot of stuff that, you know, getting into conspiracy that government knows that we don't, that don't want to let us know. Who shot JFK being the biggest one and the reasons why, although we've kind of figured it out. Will that ever change? Will it continue along these lines, the manipulation of the human?
Oh, I think it'll change, and I think they'll come up with new ways to manipulate us and swaggle tooth us, you know? And, yeah. But the thing is certain things can only be like held back as far as we let them, you know. So now with the invention of the internet and social media and all these things have created a global awareness that where information is transmitted instantly, you know. And so we just live in a new and exciting age where the rules are constantly changing. So whatever it is, look, if the flat earth people are right, you know what I mean? We're going to figure it out pretty soon. We're going to figure out if it's just because the GoPros have a curved lens or not, you know? Like, probably not.
Does it really even matter anyways,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. You know, and I think a big problem with the past that I read in the Graham Hancock book with and Russell Carlson, that all these different expertise are separated. You know, the people that are an expert in geology are separate from the people that are an expert in theology, and separate from the people that are into Egyptology versus, you know, archaeology. And the thing is, so these people, once you become just an expert in your very narrow field of expertise, you know, you don't really have a whole lot of other interaction with people that are an expert on this other area of expertise, and then you never get a chance to combine all the ideas and get the big picture behind of all, like, what does it all mean? Mm-hmm. And that's where over the past, you know, 20 years with the internet and social media and all these like ways that we're all becoming more aware of each other, and maybe over the next, you know, 50 years, you know, we're going to reach this point where everyone's just more well-rounded, and we have, and even the experts that are, you know, that they focus on a very specific thing, you know. So the more that we become open to information and a little bit more humble to realize maybe we have something to learn, and maybe something that we maybe a lot of ideas that I have right now, you know, I've come to realize that I've had those established ideas for almost longer than I can remember. Like, well, this is what I believe. Well, why? Well, is that just something that I kind of came up? Yeah, either was told it as a child, I came up with it when I was 14, and, you know, maybe it's time to reevaluate some stuff and really, like, to open my ideas to, like, let me relearn some stuff. And maybe definitely the version of myself today will be able to come up with something, a better understanding than I was, you know, before.
Mm-hmm. What's the best book that somebody can read to kind of learn about this? Is there one that stands out for you guys?
Well, for this particular topic, I would definitely dive into Magician of the Gods by Graham Hancock. Mm-hmm. That book is fascinating. And it is a sequel to his first book, Fingerprints of the Gods, which is also great. But in Magicians of the God, he gets a lot into Göbekli Tepe and the discovery and the unearthing of that, which is incredibly fascinating, you know. We kind of got off topic, but something about that's really interesting is these monoliths. They're
from earlier.
Yeah, yeah. The carvings on them aren't like etched inside. The carvings are there's a word for it.
Raised.
Yeah, they're raised. Raised. So
there's a word for it. I can't think of it.
Yeah, I'm trying to think through my Photoshop filter. The opposite of beveled. Whatever the opposite of beveled is. So they're raised. So, like, if you see this giant slab of a giant pillar, there's like a monkey, and then a lion, and then like a falcon, but with like human arms. But it's raised. Mm-hmm. So they had to chisel around it. So they chiseled out the negative space of all these monoliths, and they get less and less and less sophisticated
as you go along. Right.
And so the guy that's unearthing this thing is going to go, we're just counting on finding the one that starts that's older, that gets worse. But every time they find an older one, it's better.
Right.
And they've only unearthed like 10% of these
things.
And
that is so bizarre, considering, you know, you're going back in time, not even just like,
right,
whether or not the humans were, or whoever created it, were more sophisticated, but just the time.
Mm-hmm.
You would think that it would get, you know, war by just the elements,
sure, yeah.
You know what I mean?
It should get better war as you progress into history, because it's newer, further back.
Because going against their argument that these are just hunter-gatherers that didn't know how to organize.
It goes back to the statues on Easter Island where there's like 50 of them and they're all exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
How do you do that?
Wasn't somebody just talking to us the other day, too, that they actually found bodies attached to those under the surface now?
Under is the, that, of the Easter Island?
The Easter Island.
There's a few images floating around the internet that are Photoshopped that they aren't. There's no whole bodies, but they do go
beneath the surface.
They do go torso.
Okay.
They go down.
Do people know that you guys are into this stuff? Is this kind of common knowledge? Like, do people come up to you and give you theories and then check this out type of thing?
You know,
because they will now.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, there's little we do some interviews and stuff where we kind of like don't go so deep into it. This is definitely the deepest we've ever gone into it.
Last question: what does Gemini syndrome mean? Is there a certain? It just sounds cool.
it means all this, you know. I mean,
truly,
the symbolism. You know, what I mean, the whole symbolism is we have this is us.
Yeah, that's your sign. That's your created
sign. It's our duality.
Yeah,
it's our yin and our yang. It's the part of us. It's the devil on this shoulder and the angel on this shoulder. Mm-hmm. And but we're united by
the Möbius strip.
We're by our DNA, our genetics, by our biology, by our, you know, by our nature, you know, and our nurture, by our concept of infinity, by our concept of eternity. You know, Aaron brought up the how we can't we can perceive infinity, and there's this great quote by Eckhart Tolle where he says, you know, if everything was blue, you know, you wouldn't know what blue was. You wouldn't be able to even see blue. You know what I mean? Because everything will be blue. So in the same way, you know, the only way that we can see the proof that there is infinity is by the very fact that we can see death. And because we can see death and acknowledge death, then that means there has to be the other side. There has to be the opposite of death. If all there was death, we wouldn't even be able to see it.
It's interesting, man. Unbelievable.
I got to plug one book
It's not a
nonfiction book, but it's written by Robert Anton Wilson and Robert Shea called The Illuminatus Trilogy. And he starts off in the first page of the book before the story even begins. He said, this is guerrilla ontology. Ontology being the study of reality and guerrilla being guerrilla warfare. So it is a 1,348-page assault on your perception of what's real and what's not. And it's told in a story format, but certainly a lot of actual factual historical stuff is put in there in the story. But it's definitely dealing with conspiracies on all fronts, whether it be the Masons, the government, the Illuminati, the Knights Templar, so on and so forth, all the way back to Atlantis, to high magic. It's the most, I've probably read it 5 or 6 times in my life. The first time it took me 9 months, and then the second time I did it in 3 days.
Wow.
And it's, you always find something new. But Robert Anton Wilson was friends with Carl Jung and with Timothy Leary. He was a psychologist. His first gig was actually writing for Playboy as an editor.
And you read it for the articles.
Yeah, exactly, right? So that makes me question Hugh Hefner's alliance to whatever he was involved in.
This guy
propagating the Illuminati was, you know, sure, one of his employees. Anyway, I find it fascinating. And within it, there's so many other references that you can go off and start researching other stuff. And he kind of trickles in there very subtly.
There's a lot to digest here, and it's been unbelievable. I'm really glad that we met up and talked to the truck stop because it made a whole different view of this whole thing. So,
for sure.
Great stuff, guys. Thank you.
Thanks for having us, man.
It's great.
All right, thanks to Aaron and Brian from Gemini Syndrome. I don't know about you, but I'll definitely be checking out a couple of those books that Aaron recommended. It was great touring with Gemini, especially with Aaron and his albinoism, as he said, his albinoism. So I never met a guy struck with that disease before or has that disease before. And I learned a lot from Aaron. He's a great guy, great singer, and Gemini Syndrome is an awesome band. So I'm looking forward to hearing the new Gemini Syndrome record. It's the third in a trilogy, and they're going to be starting recording next month. It might be out by the end of the year. If not, we'll just have to wait and see. But what you should not wait on is booking your cabin for Chris Jericho's Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea. Cabins are going, man, going steady. We're on a sellout pace. Some decks already sold out, but you still got time to make the list. Everybody wants to know, hey, how do I make the list? Can you put me on the list? If you book your cabin before January 15th, 2018, about 2.5 weeks from now, 3 weeks from now, you take a picture with me in the list. And you know what happens? When you go on the Chris Jericho Rock and Wrestling Rager and you book your cabin before January 15th, you know what happens? Huh? You just made the list. Yeah, that's how you make the list. Book your cabin before January 15th. You still got some time. Go to ChrisJerichoCruise.com and take a picture of me with the list. I'll even write your name on it. For as low as $150, you can reserve your cabin. ChrisJerichoCruise.com. Everything included in the price. Remember that. All food, all the activities, all the wrestling matches, live comedy shows, live podcasts, Fozzie concerts, King concerts. Everything. It's all inclusive with the price of your cabin. The only thing you got to pay for is drinks and gambling. And if you're a teetotaler, then you don't got to pay a damn thing. And you'll be able to come hang out on the ship with all of these incredible guests. Now remember, they're not sequestered behind a wall. This is not Game of Thrones. We are all on the ship together. So who knows who you're running to, eat dinner with, go to a show with, hang out with, have a drink with, gamble with. Jim Ross, Jerry the King Lawler, SoCal Val, Mick Foley, Rick of the Dragon Steamboat, Rey Mysterio, the Keep It 100 crew, Conan, Disco Inferno, Shane House, Killing the Town with Cyrus and Paul Lazenby will be there. Beyond the Darkness with Tim and Dave, Brad Williams, Ron Funches, Jim Brewer, all doing comedy. Busted Open Radio is going to be there with LaGreca and Larry David, Larry Dallas, whatever the hell his name is. Fozzie, Phil Campbell and the Bastard Sons, King, Jim Brewer's Loud and Rowdy, The Dives featuring Evan Stanley, The Dave Spivak Project featuring Speewee, The Darlings of Rock and Roll, Cherry Bombs, The World's Greatest Female AC/DC Cover Band, Shoot the Thrill, The World's Greatest Male Ozzy Cover Band, Blizzard of Ozzy, and of course, Ring of Honor is presenting the Sea of Honor Tournament aboard the ship in the middle of the ocean. We got a ring sequestered, a ring that's we had to have a team of engineers come to make sure that this ring could be safely tied down to the middle of the ship, and we got it. So the entire Ring of Honor, the top guys are going to be there. They're competing in the Sea of Honor tournament because the winner gets a shot at the Ring of Honor World Heavyweight Championship in the future. The Young Bucks, Nick and Matt, will be there. The Villain, Marty Scurll. The American Nightmare, Cody. Don't call him Rhodes. Cody's wife, Brandi Rhodes. The Briscoe Brothers, Dalton Castle, Colt Cabana, and Marty DeRosa will be there doing their unprofessional wrestling podcast. Think Mystery Science Theater, but watching bad wrestling matches instead. That's going to be hilarious. We've got some more Ring of Honor talents to be announced. Everything's just going along great. So if you want to be a part of this, go reserve your cabin now at ChrisJerichoCruise.com. And don't forget, DDP will be there doing live yoga on the ship. And you can check out DDP Yoga by going to DDPYoga.com, DDPYoga.com/Jericho to take advantage of DDP's biggest holiday sale ever. Get 30% off the DDPY DVDs, the app, and all related merch. Thanks to Geico. Save money on your car insurance. You're going to need to save money after Christmas. Thank you so much for listening. Keep listening for the 60-second AP News headlines coming up next and coming up on Wednesday, the day after Christmas, in honor of Lars Ulrich's birthday. It's my first classic album clash. We're going to do Ride the Lightning versus Master of Puppets with Brian Posehn and Frankie Kazarian. We're going to be discussing which album is better, go through a track-by-track debate on which song we like best, and we're going to pay tribute to Lars and Metallica. It's the classic album clash. We'll see you on Boxing Day. Thank you so much. Have a great Christmas. Be safe, guys. Don't drive drunk. Be good to yourself. I hope you get everything you want. I hope you make it on a Santa's list. I hope you stay off of Jericho's list. And we're really excited about the new year. Some big announcements coming. Thank you so much, guys. We will see you on Boxing Day. In the meantime and in between time, stay safe, stay hard, stay hungry. Peace, love, and hugs. And a big, yeah, boy, Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy Yeah Boy.
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas.
Daddy, where do babies come from?
Honey?
Mommy went to the store.
Oh, well, you see, well, there's a mommy and a daddy, right?
Right.
And see, when they call Geico, they could save a bunch of money on car insurance.
Oh, really? And that makes them happy?
Yes, that makes them very happy.
That's good.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we could have this talk, Sunshine.
Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
Okay, Kevin, for the grand prize of $1 million, what color is the White House?
I know this.
Five seconds.
Oh, switching to Geico could save you a bunch of money on car insurance?
Okay. Judges? That's true, Kevin. They'll allow it. Congratulations. You're a winner.
Woo!
Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
Syria Peace Talks? I'm Ben Thomas with an AP News Minute.
Syrian rebels have rejected peace talks being proposed by Russia. They're accusing Moscow of failing to pressure its ally, President Bashar Assad, to end the conflict. Christmas may be over, but the shopping isn't. Hazel Ginn was at Macy's Herald Square in New York today.
It's not too bad. Even we went up to the 9th floor, and we managed to get in a queue of about 4 deep, so not bad. Yeah, and then we went to another one, and it was only a couple, so we kind of timed it well, I think.
America's research group, which focuses on consumer behavior, projects holiday sales up about 5% this year. Harley Davidson is placing a renewed emphasis on teaching people to ride as part of its efforts to attract more customers. The company is expanding the number of dealerships with a Harley Riding Academy. The move comes as the industry grapples with years of declining sales and an aging customer base. I'm Ben Thomas.